Good morning. Welcome to each one. Greet you in Jesus' name. Probably the main word in my title this morning is generally considered a negative. Maybe I should say it this way: how many of you enjoy feeling like a failure? Or maybe you've never felt that way. Thankfully, it's not something I have to feel like every day, but occasionally we just have those days where we feel like a failure. So I wanted to talk about the four fetters of failure. Somebody, first of all, what is failure? If you say you feel like a failure, what are you saying? Anyone? Didn't get it right. Okay. Any other ways you express it? Okay. Feel terrible? Good for nothing. Okay. Didn't attain. So there's a lot of ways we could say it isn't there. We didn't reach our goal. We didn't achieve what we had planned to or wanted to. A little bit back to what Ernie said originally, a miss. I had to think of a couple. One of the things that brought this to my mind was I stumbled across something that's called the 10 biggest failure of all time, I think it was. And I don't know how you determine that. You can determine it on dollar amount or lives lost or in all sorts of ways. So that's a bit difficult to say. If I would hesitate to say that the list I saw was actually the biggest ones. But I'll just give you a couple that I thought were interesting that I didn't know about. Or at least if I had, I'd forgotten. So the first one was in 1626, a long time ago. The king of Sweden wanted to expand his kingdom. And so he was fighting war with a couple of his neighbors, and he thought one way to help win this war was to build a biggest warship that the world had ever seen. So they built this great big wooden ship. They spent 5% of the gross domestic product on it, which today, that would have been around $27 billion if you'd use Sweden's numbers today. So I don't know, but it was 5%. I mean, it was basically 5% of the economy. Just imagine, it's a huge part. Anyway, when they got this thing done, it took them a few years to get it done, and he was in a hurry to have it out there. And being a king, you don't argue with the king or tell him that his idea was stupid, I guess. So they built this thing, and there was a lot of people that should have known better. Long story short, they launched this thing, and a huge crowd had gathered, was cheering this thing on. This was going to be a new age in the country. And the thing didn't even get 1 mile from where it started out, and an extra strong puff of wind come along, and it tipped over and sank. So, pretty major failure. Of course, the king, he didn't like responsibility for this, so he tried to find someone else, but I don't know that they actually... One article I read said they never actually totally assigned it. But anyway, that was one. So we can look back, 1600s, they were sort of funny, right? Maybe I'll... Two more recent ones that are sort of in the same vein was the Spanish government. I think it was in 2012, but I may be wrong on the exact day. It's fairly recent. They had this plan to build a fleet of 4 submarines that were going to be world class. And they were going to do this themselves. So they were going to design it in Spain, build it in Spain, do everything themselves. It was going to be the pride of Spain. And this whole project was supposed to cost around $3 billion. Well, they got this thing designed and they began building it, only to realize that there's some confusion here, so maybe if you read something different. But it seems like somebody got a decimal point in the wrong place. And so as they started, they were $680 million into this when they discovered that these things would never float. Now a submarine's supposed to sink, but these were going to go to the bottom and never come back up, which is not supposed to be. So they had to add, at least the one area said they had to add 10 meters, about 30 feet to the hull to get enough buoyancy to float this thing. And so they went ahead and did this. It expanded the cost tremendously. And after they got that done, they discovered that the harbor where these things were supposed to go to refuel and stuff couldn't handle them, so they had to spend a whole pile more money to get the harbor to where they could get them in and out. And I don't know if you're an American about now, you're starting to think the Europeans are a little funny, aren't you? But just so, I guess I have to tell you one more big fail. This was in 1999. NASA, the space exploration part of the government here in the U.S., had ordered Mars, some sort of thing to send to Mars to look around, take pictures, and maybe even probe the surface. And so when they ordered it, they used the metric system, meters, centimeters, kilograms, all that for the launch force and speed, all that was in kilograms. Well, Lockheed Martin built this thing for them, and somehow in the whole thing, they got this thing switched over to English without doing any conversions. And so when this thing got to Mars, guess what happened? Their hundreds of millions of dollars just smashed right down into Mars and burnt up. So it makes a big difference, doesn't it? And you know, I'm sure in each one of these instances, there was probably some people that had some really bad days, don't you think? I've never lost that kind of money, and I've had some bad days on a whole lot less, so I can only imagine. But in thinking about failure, moving now more into maybe things that pertain to me, what would you say separates the real men and women from, shall I say, the wimps? Don't we all fail? So what separates? You see, some people, they fail, and it sort of seems that's the end. They quit, or at least you never hear of them again. And then there's other people that they fail, and some of them fail again. I thought it was interesting. I just looked at a number of famous people in business world. I think it was Henry Ford would have been one. I think Bill Gates was another one. We could keep going. But a lot of those have a number of failures, failed business ventures underneath their experience before they had a success that we now remember them for. So what separates it? And then maybe even more important in the spiritual, I think we see somewhat of the same, don't we? Don't we sometimes see people that have had a difficult life experience, and yet they're amazing Christians? You see others that, I don't know, I would hesitate. We probably all have what seems difficult to us. But I've seen some that in comparison don't look that difficult. And haven't really gone where I should have. What's the difference? You know, is it never having failed, or is there something even more basic? I want to be clear, while mistakes and failures are never pleasant and often have long-reaching consequences, it does, just like take that submarine. Now you're not only fixing a submarine, you're changing a harbor, you're building different buildings, the whole thing. Yet there's still a way forward through that. You know, if there's something worse than failure, what is that something or some things? As I get into this, I thought maybe I should just put a disclaimer here. I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't think anybody in their right mind, in whatever capacity, should try to go out and fail, right? That's not what we're talking about. Don't care. That was funny. I just spent, in the case of the submarines, another $1 billion. You know, that's not responsible. We're not talking about that. But we're talking about a responsible person to the large degree that messed up. And if I mess up, if I fail, does that need to be the end of the road? It makes me think of a customer I had a number of years ago, and he had a very kind perspective. Wind had actually blown his doors out, and so we put new ones in. And I didn't like his configuration. It was just, without getting complicated, the way they were installed previously was just a prone way of doing it. And sure enough, we tried to keep him happy, so we did it the way it had been done, and he had all kinds of problems, and I went back, and I went back, and I went back to try to get these things working. One day, I told him, I said, I'm awful sorry, I should have just never done this for you. And he says, oh no, he said, I'm sort of glad I had problems, because now I know you're going to take care of me. So, while thinking on doors, that's one thing, but I sort of was trying to take his attitude into the rest of life. You know, so often I'm wishing I wouldn't have failed. So often it's easy to think, at least for me, just give up. Why didn't I stay in bed? But the bigger thing is actually how we relate to it, right? How we go from here. My response to failing tells you more about me than the failure. My response to failing tells you more about me than the failure. Okay, so the four fetters of failure. Can anybody tell me what fetters are? Okay, so something that ties you up. Handcuffs would be fetters, or anklets. ankle chains, whatever. So there's a lot of different fetters. So I want to think of how failure tends to mess with us, I guess, if you want to say it that way, how it mixes us up. I have often found in my own life, currently and in looking back, oftentimes the way I related to my failure actually caused me more problems than the initial failure would have. Does that make sense? And so what are some of the ways, I'm not saying I'm comprehensive here, but what are some of the ways that when I fail, the devil actually uses it to tie me up? Makes me think of a number of years ago, Brother Dale Heisey was counseling someone that I was along with, and he said, sin is like a chain that just wraps you up, and the more you sin, the more it wraps you up. And, you know, failure is somewhat similar. The way we feel about ourselves, the way failure works, it just wraps you up. So what are some of the ways this happens? I'm going to use Bible examples of failure for the most part. For the rest of this, I'm not saying you need to turn all these. Some of these I'll just more tell you. A lot of them you know already. But I like to think of two kings that failed and the two different results they had in that failure. The first one was in 1 Samuel 15. We have Saul told to go destroy the Amalekites. So he gathers Israel together and he goes to do what he's told to do. And he's told to kill everything, animals, everything. Nothing is supposed to be left when he comes back alive. And he comes back and in this account we're told Samuel heard the animals. I guess later he discovered that the king was alive as well. And so he comes and says, Saul, you know, what's this? What is this that you did? And Saul says, Samuel said, verse 14, Samuel said, what meaneth the bleating of the sheep in mine ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul's answer was, and Saul said, they have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice unto the Lord thy God, and the rest we have utterly destroyed. Notice how Saul immediately, well, they, you know those people, I just couldn't control them. That's a pretty lame excuse for a king, really. You know, if anybody should have been able to control what happened, it was Saul, and he didn't. And so now he's passing it off. And then he does two things. First of all, he says he blames someone else. And then secondly, he says, oh, but we did utterly destroy everything else. So maybe that makes up. But notice how there was no, he didn't take personal responsibility. It was somebody else's fault and try to push up where he had done right. Now, if I was to rate sin or failure as a man, I would probably rate the second king as actually having done a worse thing. But I want you to notice the difference. The second one is in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. We have David's sin with Bathsheba. So we all know that story. I don't have to go a lot into it. Sin with Bathsheba, and then how he, I guess I would say he murdered Uriah. I know somebody else did the killing, but it was at his setup. And then when Nathan comes and tells him this story about this poor man that had one lamb and the rich man came and killed it, you know, David, he gets all huffy and he says, that man's going to die and give back fourfold. So he just passed a judgment that he actually couldn't ever have fulfilled in where he had done wrong. And then Nathan just tells him, you are the man. You are the man. And again, I've wondered how much different this rest of David's life could have been if he would have come and said, I messed up. But anyway, he owned it. And then in verse 13, he tells, and David said unto Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. I'm pretty sure David was just as human as Saul, and it probably would have been a lot of fun to blame someone else. He could have blamed Bathsheba, saying she was where she shouldn't have been, or on and on. But he says, I have sinned against the Lord. Then I had to go to Psalm 51, verse 1 through 4. Just notice how he takes full responsibility for all of this. I don't think you ever find David blaming anyone else for his actions. He says this, Psalm 51, verse 1. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness, according to the multitude of thy tender mercies. Blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgressions, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. So the first fetter of failure that I have is failure to acknowledge and accept responsibility for my actions. I should point out that when David accepted responsibility for his failure, it didn't negate the reaping. He still had to reap. But it did put him on a path to redemption. It did put David where he ended up totally different at the end of life from what Saul did. And he says, I have sinned, and my sin is ever before me. You know, this fetter has a couple different ways that I think it comes out in different ones of us in different cases. I think some people you see when they're faced with sin, with failure, whatever it is, you can deny that there's a problem, right? That decimal point was at the right place. So-and-so just did it wrong. And you can go on and on. Denial. I don't have a problem. There is no problem. And I guess the biblical example of that to me would be Cain. When God asked him, you know, where is your brother? He says, am I my brother's keeper? The idea being, I don't know anything about it. That was denial. A flat lie in his case. Sometimes we're probably a little bit more adept. I'm not saying that we flat out lie. At the same time, do we deny? And I've found myself doing this in different ways. It's so easy. Maybe something doesn't get ordered like it should, or something's not on a truck. And I know I was involved, but potentially was somebody else involved here? You know, how was this? Or maybe it's something in the home life. Do I deny that it started here, and that should as might as well end here? The second one is minimization. It isn't all that bad. Or maybe we excuse it as being normal, natural. And I had to think of Lot when he was he couldn't get broke loose from Sodom. When they finally broke him loose and he's told to go to the hills, he says, oh, can I go to this city? And I think his phrase there was, it's just a little one. And I wonder if that wasn't Lot's whole attitude about life. You know, he had to have known what was going on in Sodom, but he was saying, one of those things. It's not good, but it's a little one. When in all reality, it was a terribly serious. And even notice, I don't know, I guess I can't, I don't want to speculate wrongly, but do you think Lot going to that little city, that trying to minimize what he actually faced, potentially led his daughters to do what they did later on? I don't know. Just a question I had. But minimization, just saying it's a little one, it's not a big deal, just keep it small. Usually the third step or thing that you do in this case of denial is justification. I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. I had to think of Aaron. His is the classic example of justification. You know, he said, yeah, they brought me this gold and I put it in the fire and this calf came out. Seriously. Does anybody in their right mind believe it? But when you're in this frame of mind, it sounds plausible, doesn't it? You put this thing out, and yeah, they wanted something, so this calf came out. We know that's not the case, yet when you're doing it, or when I'm doing it, somehow it sounds almost plausible. Then the last one I had in this thing of not taking responsibility is what I call shifting responsibility. And this is something that's pretty easy to do, because unless you live around perfect people, which I don't think any of us do, you can always shift it, right? There's always somebody else connected to your problem somehow, to your failure. In all reality, take David, for instance. He didn't sin by himself. Bathsheba had a role in that. She did, and I don't know how the repentance process went for her or whatever. But evidently, there was a connection. And so in responsibility shifting, rather than just accepting, yes, this started with me, it didn't include only me, let it stop with me. I had to think of Adam started that process so many years ago, and we're still at it full-fledged today, aren't we? When God came and says, what have you done, Adam? And what was his first words? The woman thou gavest me. And so he blamed two people in that phrase, right? He blamed Eve, and he was blaming God. You know, God, if you'd have just kept that woman out of my way, I would have never gone there. Seriously. But again, it sounds plausible when we're in that mode. Moving on to the next one, I had to think of the account of Saul and Israel. I'm going to say cowering before Goliath in 1 Samuel 17. And so you have them come together for a battle, and as I understand it, they were there 40 days. And so it seems like almost daily, this Goliath, this huge man, would come out and say, you know, send one person to fight with me and we can save a big war. If he beats me, good, we'll be your servants. If I beat him, you'll be my servants, and it'll save a lot of lot of lives, and this will be a good way to go. And verse 11 in Samuel 17 says, "When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine," meaning Goliath, "they were dismayed and greatly afraid." And if you go down to verse 16, it tells you that this went on for 40 days. So David comes on the picture, and it sounds like they're all set up to fight. They're shouting for the battle is the phrase it uses. And here comes Goliath out of the host again and says, "Hey, you know, we really don't have to do this. Come fight with me." And he repeats his challenge. And notice what it says in verse 24 and 25. I'll just read them to you. "And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, Goliath, fled from before him and were sore afraid. And the men of Israel said, 'Have ye seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel he has come up.'" Anyways, it goes on. I think the second fetter that binds to failure is fear. Fear. Here you had a whole, I don't know, probably thousands on the low side, I don't know how many, of people whose job it was to fight, to protect their families, to take care of the problem. And yet they all ran away from one man. Every last one of them. Until a young man showed up. The fetter of fearfulness. Add to Proverbs 26, verse 13 says this, "The slothful man saith, there is a lion in the way. A lion is in the streets." So I think fear has potentially two ways it comes. There's the slothful man that pretends he's scared when he's just too lazy. Too much hassle. And I don't know, maybe you've never done that, but you excuse something you know you should do because after all, there's possibly a lion there. It's not real serious, but it makes a good excuse. Sounds good to the person saying it. Or it is possible that fear is very real, as in the case of the Israelites here before Goliath. But you know what? I don't care whether it's real or whether imagined. Either way, if fear is not controlled and conquered, it will control and conquer me. Fearfulness. You know, 1 John 4, verse 18, verse probably we all know, it says, "There is no fear in love." When I relate to the circumstances of life, even failure in fear, I have lost the love of God in my heart. "But perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love." I think it's only natural, and to some degree it's right, that if I find myself failing, that there's some introspection, some consideration what has brought me to this point. I'm not saying there's no place for that. But finally, when that morphs into fear that keeps me from trying again, it's become a controlling factor. 2 Timothy 1, verse 7, just a verse I'd like to read as well on this, says, "For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind." And I think sometimes if we found ourselves failing, maybe one of the most important things to do is just stop ourselves. And is my response, is the way I plan to either move ahead or not move ahead because of this experience, have any tentacles of fear involved in it? And if it does, that needs to be weeded out if we're going to make it through. I like a phrase I found here. It says, "Fear immobilizes, faith empowers." Whenever I find myself unable to move because, and I excuse it, generally it's fear-based. You know, faith enables me to keep doing what God has for me to do. Finally, we need to forge ahead. The next one is moving on to the next step in this process. I had to think of Elijah at Mount Carmel. You know how he called all those prophets of Baal together? And they have this day on the mountain, and the prophets of Baal have their big shindig, and nothing works for them. Then Elijah calls on God, and fire comes and burns all this up. And I often tried to put myself in Elijah's shoes. Why did he respond? You know, then he asked for rain, and this little cloud came up, and soon there was rain, and he had a miraculous day all around. Yet at the end of the day, it seems like when Jezebel sent that message that by this time tomorrow, you're going to be dead like the prophets of Baal, He forgot all about that. And I've wondered, he was only human, but what triggered his response? And looking at that, I've wondered, I don't know, I can't prove this, but I've wondered, do you think Elijah expected, he wanted to see a huge revival in Israel, right? And with all the things that happened, don't you think he thought, well, now if these people have any sense, they'll rise up against Jezebel and all this. But they didn't. They gave lip service that the Lord, he is God, but they went home and did what? As far as I can tell, most of them continued serving Baal. So while this was a great day in a lot of ways for Elijah, at the end of the day, nothing had really changed, if you want to say that that way. And I wonder if it was just the disappointment of seeing his smashed expectations. I don't know. But that brings me to that fourth, to the fetter of discouragement. The third fetter of discouragement. You know, I don't know, discouragement probably is one of the most, well, fear is too, so I shouldn't say discouragement is more, and they sort of connect together. But have you noticed when you feel discouraged, nothing is worth effort, is it? I don't know if you're, but when you're discouraged, and the interesting thing about discouragement, maybe I should say the sad thing, is somehow when we're discouraged, especially let's say in a spiritual failure, it actually sets us up to fail again. I don't know if you've ever noticed that. But at least for me, if I've failed, I know I've failed, and I'm discouraged with how I've failed, somehow there's a little bit of in discouragement, there's a little bit of entitlement or something that this is worthless. Why even try? And sort of builds you up to fail again. Going on to the last of the fetters, I had to think of Elisha and Joash, king of Israel, in 2 Kings 13 through, this accounts 2 Kings 13, verse 14 through 20. And Elisha was dying. He was an old man. His days were numbered. And a king came, a young man seemingly, comes to visit him. He knows he's dying. And interesting thing about this young man, in some ways he was semi-sincere. He wasn't willing to go all the way with God. Yet, on one hand, he was appreciating Elisha. And so Elisha tells him, he says, come in here. And he says, you know, you've been fighting with Syria, some of my own words. He said, I'd like to give you a sign about this. He said, open that window. Bring your bow and arrows over to me. And then it sounds like he told Elisha told Joash to shoot out the window while he had his hands on the bow and arrow as well. And so Joash did all this. And he knew at this point that this was all symbolic of what God, through Elisha, wanted to give him a prophecy about relating to Syria. After they shot the arrow, Elisha makes this comment that he says, that's the arrow of the Lord's deliverance from Syria. Now he says, take the rest of your arrows and beat the ground with them. So this young king takes these arrows and he hits the ground 3 times and stops. So that brings us to the fetter of what I'm going to call apathy. Apathy. I've often wondered, what would have happened to the Syrians, you think, if Joash would have started just beating that ground savagely till Elisha would have, hey, stop, stop, stop. I'm going to need a little bit left to test you in the future, right? But that's not at all what happened. In fact, Elisha strongly rebukes him and says, you know, if you would have kept on going, you would have solved the Syria problem, in my words, forever. But he says, because you only did it 3 times, you're going to only win 3 times. And how sad is that? And I've wondered, I think fear and discouragement both lead to apathy, and maybe there's some other paths that lead there as well. But just don't have the energy. Don't have a vision. Don't have whatever it is. Ecclesiastes 9:10 says it this way, whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. And he gives us the reason, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. The New Testament changes that a bit, and it says, somewhat changing it to my own words, but he tells us that whatsoever we find to do, do it with our might because of God in us. You know, when we half-heartedly do whatever God has for us, it's not bringing glory to him. You know, one thing I think that often happens in our circles is that we excuse lack of fire as a personality thing. And I disagree. I've seen some very quiet, very non-splashy people, I'll say, that I think have had a real fire. And you can see it. It's not saying that maybe the world sees it, but don't ever excuse a lack of fire on, oh, that's not my personality. I don't care what personality God has given you. He wants your energy devoted to Him. And yes, that may be done different ways at different times with different people, absolutely. But don't ever, when we start excusing that that's just not our personality, I really question whether we've not undermined the very thing that makes a Christian almost. It's just not worth the effort. I just don't have the energy. I'm just too busy. Then one last illustration of a young man I had to think of. We have the three different accounts that we have to piece this together from. We have Barnabas and Paul going on the first missionary journey. We have the church at Antioch getting together and praying, and the Spirit says, separate to me Barnabas and Paul for the work whereunto I've called them. And they head out, and evidently there's some others with them. Seems Luke traveled with Paul a lot. He may have been along at this point. And there was evidently a young man by the name of John Mark. And I don't know, it's not very far into this account. They sailed to one side of Cyprus. Seems like they walked across Cyprus because they departed from Paphos. And in Paphos, they had met this ruler, a high-up man, I guess I'll call him. And he was interested in the gospel. But there was a witch doctor, sorcerer, that was there trying to persuade him against the gospel. And I don't know if something happened there that discouraged John Mark, because after Paphos, they sailed to Perga in Pamphylia, it says. And in Perga, anyways, for whatever reason, John Mark says he departed. See. And John, departing from them, returned to Jerusalem. So I don't know. Did they have a stormy sea? But somewhere between, it seems somewhere between crossing Cyprus and getting to Perga, John Mark's, I don't know if what to say, his energy left him, or his, what had taken him on the trip no longer was there. And this was evidently evident to the people around him, because in Acts chapter 15 then, after they'd returned, and it says, and some days after, Paul said unto Barnabas, let us go again and visit our brethren in every city wherein we have preached the word of the Lord, and see how they do. And it says this, and Barnabas determined to take with them John, whose surname was Mark. So I think it was actually, if you look overall, I'm pretty sure Barnabas was John Mark's uncle. So uncle determined to give John Mark, shall I say, another chance. It seems Paul was just as determined. It says this, and Paul thought it not good to take him with them who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. So basically John Mark became the object of the first church split, I guess, if you want to call it that. I'm not saying they didn't relate together afterwards, but it tells us that Paul and Barnabas separated because of how they felt different about John Mark. And if we'd stop there, I wouldn't really have any basis to know how John Mark turned out. But if you go to 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11, Paul writes this to Timothy. He says, only Luke is with me. Take Mark, John Mark, and bring him with thee, for he is profitable to me for the ministry. So John Mark made a mistake, and probably in all likelihood, maybe Paul was actually in the right that he didn't deserve another chance. I can't say that he did. But because somebody gave him another chance, helped him through that failure, even Paul in later years admitted that, you know, this man is good for the work that God has given him. So I guess to my ending point is, if you fail, the very best thing you can do is to try again. Makes me think of the saying known for many years, if at first you don't succeed, try again. You know, if you fail, try again, or your failure will own you. Makes me think of somebody that was that learning to ride a horse, and I think they got thrown, and they said, if you don't get up off the ground and get on that horse right away, you'll probably never get on a horse again. And you know, that's how failure is. If we give up, if we sit down, I can't do this, your failure will own you. That fear will build up. And the sooner you confront it and div through it, work through it, the better. Proverbs 24, verse 15 and 16 says this. Lay not wait, O wicked man, against the dwelling of the righteous. Spoil not his resting place. For a just man falleth seven times and riseth up again. But the wicked shall fall into mischief. I can't tell you, that's probably been one of the verses that has encouraged me most in my lifetime, especially when I went through cycles of failure and defeat, is that wording of that verse just amazes me, for it says, a just man falleth seven times. You know, it still called him just. And to me, that's so precious, because God doesn't give up on us just because we fall. But where we become hopeless is when we stay down. It calls him just. The just man riseth up again. But the really wicked person is the one that when he falls, just stays there. He will find mischief. A couple of verses out of Isaiah, I think, might be slightly out of context, but I like the wording here. Isaiah 24, verse 17 through 18 says, fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth. And it shall come to pass that he who fleeth from the noise of fear shall fall into a pit. And he that cometh up out of the pit, and he that cometh up out of the midst of the pit shall be taken in a snare. For the windows from on high and open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. You know, if we have failed, if we find ourselves dealing with fear, dealing with discouragement, dealing with apathy, I just like, notice the wording here again. Fear and the pit and the snare are upon thee, O inhabitant of the earth, and it shall come to pass, he that fleeth the noise of fear. And I sort of like that phrase, noise of fear. So now, when I get scared, I often don't take much to be scared, right? You're scared before the noise comes. So you hear the noise, away you go without really knowing what it is. So noise of fear, that person is going to fall into a pit. Let's call that pit discouragement. And he that cometh up out of the pit, or he that tries to think he's getting away from discouragement, if he's not really facing it, is going to be taken in the snare of apathy. I like this poem by John Greenleaf Whittier, so bear with me if you're not a poetry person, but don't quit. When things go wrong, as they sometimes will, when the road you're trudging seems all uphill, when the funds are low and the debts are high, and you want to smile, but you have to sigh, when care is pressing you down a bit, rest if you must, but don't you quit. Life is strange with its twists and turns, as every one of us sometimes learns, and many a failure comes about when he might have won had he stuck it out. Don't give up, though the pace seems slow. You may succeed with another blow. Success is failure turned inside out, the silver tint of the clouds, no doubt. And you never can tell just how close you are. It may be near when it seems so far. So stick to the fight when your hardest hit. It's when things are worse that you must not quit. Your, my response to failing tells others more about me than our failure. Do we believe that, and do we seek to live that way? Let's stand for prayer.